It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Joe Lieberman is going to be here in a matter of moments. He has put together, or helped put together, one of the most formidable third-party organizations in my lifetime. And I don't think they're going anywhere. Even if they don't run a presidential candidate, they have a lot of money, they got a convention, they have a lot of big names. Joe Lieberman in a matter of moments, and then a little bit later, Mark Thiessen. He believes that Joe Biden's evacuation and embarrassing exit from Afghanistan makes him ineligible, impossible to win re-election. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I can't wait for the Republicans to understand that they have a responsibility to work with President Biden and come up with a solution once and for all, because the American people have been talking about immigration for decades.
Governor, stop pretending that it's the Republicans have to work with Democrats. It is flat out embarrassing what happened yesterday. New York overrun with illegal immigrants. Governor Hochul travels to the White House. The president's in the White House and doesn't even find time to say hello. It cost this city $12 billion over the last 3 years. And the president won't address it. Can I just confirm with you that they're all in the same party?
Number two.
So you're part of the 23% of adults who are not concerned about the president's ability to be president because of his age and stamina. I got it.
But
77% of adults are worried.
20 million and counting. That's how much Trump has raised since his mugshot. While DeSantis impresses all by being the man in charge of the hurricane, at the same time, calls grow for Joe Biden to say goodbye as he ages before our eyes.
Number one.
This morning, we are learning some new details about what was going on behind the scenes at the Department of Justice after an IRS whistleblower came forward alleging federal prosecutors were giving first son Hunter Biden some special treatment.
Hunter? High man of influence. Now we see the son of the president was wielding power with the State Department, John Kerry, and his deputy, Anthony Blinken, at the time. And we're still to believe his dad knew nothing about his son's overseas business dealings. Senator Joe Lieberman joins us now. He's a vice presidential candidate as well, but founding chairman of the No Labels and author of The Centrist Solution, How We Made Government Work and Can Make It Work Again. Senator, welcome back.
Hey, Brian, good to be with you. Incidentally, I love that solutions, not division line that led
absolutely
the show.
That's why I'm so intrigued by No Labels.
Thank you.
I got to ask you about one thing against a guy you know very well. I talk to people that used to travel with him all the time, like Lindsey Graham, and they indicate he's not the same guy. And he's forgetting names of people he's known all his life. And he's slowing down markedly. If you were related to Joe Biden, would you recommend he not run?
Yeah. To be really direct about it, I haven't been with him a lot in recent years, so I'm watching him publicly. He and I are the same age. And, thank God we reached it. But I really feel that Joe Biden has had an extraordinary career in public service, got elected president, did a lot as a senator, got elected president. And I just think that he'd do a favor to himself if he decided not to run again and walked off the stage with honor, really. It's time. You know, we all reached that time. I reached it at 70 when I thought it's time for me to go on to something else from the U.S. Senate. So we'll see, though. It's obviously up to him. These are powerful numbers of public opinion that you talked about all the people
77%
worried about President. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And it's not like they're against him on an issue where he can change his position on the issue if he could. I mean, this is the reality of age. So there you go. God bless him. I wish him well. I hope he makes the right decision.
But what's best for our country is what?
Well, I think it's best for him and best for the country if after all these years, I mean, he first got elected to the U.S. Senate when he wasn't even 30, wasn't even legally eligible. He became eligible before he was sworn in. So he's been in elective office most of the last half century, except for the years between the vice presidency and when he ran in 2020. For the presidency, which was 4 years. So what a record. And, go forward. I mean, he's got a wonderful family. And, you know, it's just a personal feeling. I say it with respect, say it with affection for him because we were good friends when we served in the Senate. It's his call. But if he asked me, that's what I would say.
So I was on with Piers Morgan last night, and he says Mick Jagger's a friend of his. Mick Jagger's 80, and he just did a two-and-a-half-hour concert. And he said nobody, if you saw Mick Jagger, would say, you better retire because he just got it. And I'll have to say this, Bernie Sanders. I watched Bernie Sanders the other day. Yeah. He's doing the exact same thing he did 10 years ago. So I don't think anyone listening right now thinks I'm putting down 80-year-olds. And, Senator, I know that you were considering Secretary of Defense. I know Donald Trump was thinking about it. And I don't think anyone would say you're too old. I actually think that if you ran for president now, you could do it. And I don't think your age would come up maybe for your second term. But could you be president right now? If someone put you behind the Oval Office, do you think you could make the same decisions and be almost as formidable as when you were 60?
Well, if I may be Sherman-esque, I have no interest in doing
that. True, but I'm just curious for your age, though. You know what you have
left.
Well,
I feel very good, thank God. And, but I'm certainly not as good what I was 20 years ago, 10 years ago. On the other hand, you do learn from experience. So, could I do it? Of course, I'd like to think I could, but I will never do it again. It's all individual. You know, you mentioned Mick Jagger. I think Dylan is still performing. It's kind of amazing, so it depends on the individual.
Yeah, Bob Dylan looked exhausted at 20, but so you just
well, that was that was his shtick. Yeah. At 20, we could actually still understand some of the words he was singing. As time went on, you had to impute your own meaning.
Yeah,
to his
lyrics. He sings in cursive writing. Just kind of everything blends together. Senator Lieberman, you believe when No Labels came together, I thought it was a radio show. I heard Governor Huntsman on the radio and he talked about solutions, but he's a Republican and did an unbelievable job as ambassador to Russia, by the way. He disappeared from the landscape these days. And his daughter is a fantastic anchor on a side note. But, Senator, when you saw that Trump and Biden are favorites to be their party's nominee, if that indeed happens in April, you're going to have a convention, and is No Labels going to name a president and vice presidential candidate?
Well, we might. I mean, look, it's an amazing moment because almost 50% of the American people have lost confidence in either of the major two political parties. So now you got like 49% of saying they identify themselves as independents, which is much greater than it ever has been before. And as you said, Brian, when you ask him about the race being between Presidents Trump and Biden, 65, 70, 75% say they don't like the choice. They want somebody else. So right now, what we're doing, because we're committed to, as you say, solutions, not division. And we think Trump-Biden means more division in the campaign and more whichever one of them would get elected. So right now we're trying to keep the door open to a third choice, which would be a bipartisan unity ticket. And what does that mean? We're working really hard to qualify for a third line on the ballot in all 50 states, which is not easy, but we're making real progress at it. And then, you know, as I learned long ago in Connecticut politics from somebody who said to me, in politics, a day could be a lifetime. So right now, it certainly looks like both Republicans and Democrats are headed to nominating unpopular candidates for President Trump and Biden. And if that happens, and we think a third bipartisan ticket has a reasonable chance of winning and won't just be a spoiler, I think we will do it. But we can't decide that until we get to next March, particularly after Super Tuesday primaries to decide. And then we have a convention, really unprecedented, a bipartisan national nominating convention for Dallas, Texas, in April of next year. So it's a remarkable time, and I feel good about what we're doing. What's going to happen to it? I don't know. I mean, look, at history doesn't offer much confidence to running third-party tickets to win. The last one to win, arguably, was our beloved Abe Lincoln in 1860. But this is an unusual time. I don't think the anger and the disappointment with the Republicans and Democrats has ever been greater, or the pessimism and worries of the American people about the future of the country has ever been more intense. They really want solutions, not division. And from the two major parties, they're getting a mostly division, and that's where there may be an opening for a third ticket. We'll see.
To complicate it, Cornel West is also running to the left of your former party, the Democratic Party. Here's what he said yesterday. He's a Green Party candidate. Cut 11.
They are dominated by their corporate wing. They're dominated by the militarists when it comes to foreign policy, and that he and AOC and the others are going to be, in a certain sense, window dressing. The Democratic Party is beyond redemption at this point.
So he has a different view. He wants to go more to the left, and he and when it comes to the war, he wants no part of it. I mean, he'll never win, and there's nobody who thinks he's going to win. But if he takes 3%, that would swing the election. Now, if you guys come in, it would just throw everything on its head. And a lot of Democrats are more exercised about no labels than Republicans. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. And you know what's really interesting is you talk about Cornel West. Democrats, certainly on the left, are much more agitated about no labels running a ticket than about Cornel West running. But the truth is that Cornel West is much more likely to be a spoiler, in the sense that he will definitely take votes from the Democratic ticket. And we think, because no labels, if we run a ticket, will run a bipartisan ticket, that the odds are, and our polling shows it right now, that we're going to take pretty much equally from both major parties. So we'll see. Look, the other danger here is if Cornel West really begins to show some strength, and it doesn't have to be a lot of strength. It could be 3%. 4%, he's going to lead people in the Democratic Party to say, we better go more left than we are now. And in my opinion, of course, that's not only bad for the country in terms of policy, it's a losing strategy, because the Democratic Party will lose credibility with the big middle of independents, particularly, that I talked about, and moderate Republicans and Democrats who might otherwise vote for a Democratic ticket. So this is a really historic race shaping up, and of course it's very important, because the country has so much strength, but so many problems that need solutions and not division.
Senator Lieberman, our guest, Senator, my question is, I just, from my perspective, I think what you've done is build something not for 2024, but to last. Isn't that the goal? You want this to last? So this way you could be a factor and maybe start putting people into Senate races and congressional races. Is that not the goal? Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. I mean, look, it may be that we see a moment of opportunity at the national level next year, and we run a ticket, bipartisan, and maybe we win. Or maybe we do really well and we establish ourselves as a third force with the main message to the two major parties, come on, get with it. And I quote your slogan again, our motto, we need solutions, not division. But it might well lead to another run for national office in 2028, and particularly strengthen our position in Senate and House races. That's how we started in 2010.
You won. You beat Ned Lamont after he beat you for the nomination.
There you go. As an independent, right.
Yeah.
And look, No Labels has been supporting centrist independent Republicans and Democrats for the last 5 or 10 years, and electing a bunch of them that became the House Problem Solvers Caucus in the Senate.
I would like to nominate Tulsi Gabbard for your ticket. That'll be one half, and then see what Governor Huntsman and others will do, because she's quite impressive, and she's not going to be outworked. So take a look at her. That's my nominee for you guys.
That's a good one. Those are two great names.
Have you thought about them, Joe?
Yeah, I mean, we're not really.
Did you approach her?
Fall, I haven't, but she's been at some. Tulsi Gabbard has been at some No Labels events. She's been at some of our calls just recently. She was on one of our calls just talking about policy and what we're up to. So I think there are lines of communication. But you know, in the fall, which is pretty soon now, we're going to establish a process for beginning to consider candidates, but that the main event for us now, we got to get on the ballot in 50 states with
third
choice line.
You know how to do all this stuff, and do not tell Joe Lieberman no. He'll find a way. Senator Joe Lieberman thinks America first.
Brian.
Always great, sir. Back in a moment.
Both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, I went a little long on that last segment, but Mark Thiessen's next. Mark really had an interesting column yesterday. We're both outraged on a daily basis about the way we left Afghanistan. Now, in The Atlantic, an excerpt from a book that talks about the play-by-play of what happened in Afghanistan. As bad as you think it was, as ill-thought and conceived as you may have concluded, it is worse. It is worse. So I'm going to talk to Mark Thiessen about that and what it means for electoral fortunes. Keep in mind, and you probably forgot this, but Joe Biden was riding relatively high in the polls because everything was about the vaccine. He got 70% of the public taking the vaccine. People were beginning to go back to work anyway. Whatever credit you want to give him, he was been over 50%. Since he left Afghanistan the way he did, leaving all these Americans behind, not taking any blame, blaming Trump and his generals, saying no one ever advised him that this could go awry, that they'd be collapsing before September 1st. Since that time, he hasn't been over 45%. And most polls have him at 39%. And when you watch him lately, 70% of the country said too old to govern.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I would freeze the current lines of control. I would further make a hard commitment that NATO will not admit Ukraine to NATO. That's enough to get Putin to do the deal. But I will require something even greater in return, Jesse. Russia has to exit its military alliance with China. Right now, we're pushing Russia further into China's hands. The Russia-China military alliance is the single greatest threat that the United States faces today. And so just as Nixon did it in 1972, I'll do it in reverse. Pull Russia apart from China. And by the way, get Russia to also remove its military presence in the Western Hemisphere. Get out of the Western Hemisphere.
So, President,
reopen economic relations with Russia. That's how we do it.
So If you heard some scribbling in the background, it is Mark Thiessen getting ready for his next column because he thinks that is a genius foreign policy. And he thought, why didn't I think of that? It's so effective. All you had to do is ask Vladimir Putin to stop hanging out with China, say you can keep that 20% of a country you invaded, and then just promise not to do any military exercises with them. That's going to work perfect, Mark.
It is. I think we should put this guy, parachute this guy into the Oval Office right now. We'll have world peace.
Right.
And I mean, puppies and rainbows and unicorns for everyone. It's going to be awesome.
What is your what are your thoughts that he repeats this? And I like Vivek, but I did an interview special for his book 3 years ago for our channel. And everyone, I admire his success and his ability to go out there. But this foreign policy is not worthy of his intellect.
No, it's not. And it's so amateurish. It's almost like criminally stupid. You know, the idea that, first of all, Russia and China don't have a military alliance. It's not like NATO, right, where you can, like, enter it and exit it. It's an informal, no-holds-barred or no-limits partnership that they announced. That they, before the invasion of Ukraine, Xi Jinping, he had 40 meetings with Vladimir Putin, more than any other leader in the world. He has been courting and forming Putin and forging this relationship for a long time. The idea that Vivek Ramaswamy is going to come into the Oval Office and somehow magically convince Vladimir Putin to abandon the alliance of autocracies, the informal alliance of autocracies, and join the West and be with us in exchange for 20% of Ukraine is just – it's so dumb. It's disqualifying.
Right. And he's not dumb. That's just it.
I'm not saying he's dumb. His idea is dumb. And honestly, you know, with all respect, when you have a dumb idea like this and people point out to you how dumb it is and you double down on it, that does kind of call into question your overall intelligence.
A good point. Also, your stubbornness. Maybe you realize you don't want to back out of it. And you could, I'm going to protect Taiwan until 2028. And then I'm going to go back to our strategic ambiguity. So...
I mean, but that's, again, so what he's saying is that the only reason we have any interest in Taiwan is because they produce 90% of the high-end semiconductors that we need for our economy. So his solution is we're going to get semiconductor independence by 2028, which is not going to happen. I mean, I would love it, but again, I'd also love puppies and rainbows. You know, we can increase our self-reliance on these things and we can do that, but we're not going to be semiconductor independent by 2028. But let's say magically we did have puppies and rainbows and semiconductor independence. Then he's saying after that, our commitment to Taiwan is over. And so what China hears is, so I can invade Taiwan in 2028. Got it. Marking my calendar. We're good. We need a little time to build up our military too, so this is perfect for us. We'll cut that deal. No problem. Go ahead, Vivek. Do it. I mean, it shows such a lack of understanding of how the world works, of how great power conflict has happened over it. It's like a guy who read like a foreign policy book and wrote a freshman paper coming up with like great ideas on why all the great strategic thinkers in history were wrong and came up with his own solutions and doesn't realize how amateurish and how sophomoric they are and is actually campaigning for president on them. It's so beyond... I've quite frankly never seen it.
So in this political realm right now, you wrote a column yesterday. You and I are both, like many Americans, especially those who served or have Operation Pineapple type units that gave up their 401ks to get our allies and Americans out because of the way Joe Biden decided to leave. As you may or may not have read the Atlantic story about the play-by-play of Afghanistan, it is really more epically incompetent than you can ever imagine. It really is one guy's arrogant, stubborn approach that he knows better, telling the military, pull everybody out, we'll all be fine. And when it all collapses, he blames Trump and says, no one advised me that this could happen. That is pure. Yeah, it is a lie, which went into your column. Tell me your thoughts about how the president didn't pay a price for this at the midterms, but will next time in 24.
Well, I think if he loses the presidency, and I don't know that he will, because he should have lost the midterms and he didn't, but that's another topic. But if he does lose the presidency, it'll be because of Afghanistan. And it won't be because people are going into the voting booth with the images of the dead Americans at Abbey Gate in their mind, or with the images of the Afghans falling off of the fuselage of American jets. It won't be because of that. It'll be because that was the moment when they decided he was incompetent and mentally unfit. Like, that was the turning point. If you look at the, again, my column, I go through all the polls. So if you want to get the actual numbers, I encourage you to go to the Washington Post and read my column. But before the Afghan withdrawal, before the fall of Kabul, he had never been below 50% approval. And immediately after Kabul fell, he fell below 50% for the first time. Then he went underwater, where his disapproval rose up to above his approval, and he's never recovered on that. Right. So he's been, that was the turning point where Americans said, this guy is no good. Then on top of that, his numbers starting in October, right after the withdrawal, was the first time that you saw that people said, the majority of Americans said, he's mentally unfit. He's incompetent. And his approval numbers on honesty and trustworthiness. Before Afghanistan, a majority of Americans said he's honest and trustworthy. Then they saw him lie. They saw him say, nobody advised me to keep troops in, and that wasn't true. They said the Al-Qaeda isn't with the Taliban. Wasn't true. This was an extraordinary success. Wasn't true. And they stopped listening to him, and then all of his numbers, one by one, on every other issue, fell. Because when you lie to people about one thing, they assume you lie about everything, and so they don't believe you when you say the economy is getting better. They don't believe you when they say we got a plan to control the border. They don't believe you. And so literally this one incident is what pulled the floor out from under him on every other issue. And so, yeah, they won't necessarily be voting on Afghanistan, but every American will be voting on Afghanistan.
Okay. And 77% of the country, and well over two-thirds of Democrats, think he's too old to run, but yet he's still running. Which is insane, right? I mean, it's not 70%. This is, most Democrats think he's too old. You have about seven surrogates fanned out campaigning for him because he obviously can't. He does not do interviews. He's been constantly on vacation. He has been 60 times he spent weekends in Delaware, let alone the Lake Tahoe excursions. So he can't, he's showing everyone he can't do the job. And this new book saying that he's always tired and that he's being treated like a toddler by his staff, that's not going to help, Mark.
No, it's not. But keep in mind, he won the presidency that way in 2020.
But he had no, he could honestly say he had no choice.
He won it from his basement in Delaware. He could win it from the basement in the White House. It matters. What the only chance he has of keeping the presidency is if voters look and say that we like the Republican nominee worse, less, right? So Joe Biden right now, if you go to the 538 average, or like that, they go back and they compare polling averages for every president in the history of polling. The first polling president was Harry Truman in the modern age of polling. And he is the most unpopular president in the history of presidential polling, going all the way back to World War II, except for two, Jimmy Carter and Donald Trump. They're the only ones who he is not less popular than. And with Trump, it depends on the day. He goes up and down with Trump. So if you've got the least popular president in the history of polling, why would you decide to choose the guy who competes with him for being the least popular as your nominee?
And here's the thing. I'm sure you've also seen this. Head to head, if you put Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, Trump does better head to head with Biden than those other two.
No one knows them yet. No one knows them yet. I mean, that, truly, you know, that you could say he's. I just don't buy that. I think that the problem that Trump has, and why he has it, which neither Nikki Haley or DeSantis or any of the other Republican candidates have, is that he's a known quantity, and swing voters have made their judgment about him. So, Wall Street Journal poll by Tony Fabrizio, who's used to be Trump's pollster, is a pollster for a pro-Trump super PAC. He asked people who disapprove of both Trump and Biden, who do you disapprove of more? And Biden won that by 39 points. 56 to 15. So the voters who disapprove of Joe Biden, who we need to vote for the Republican to come over, disapprove of Trump even more by a 39-point spread. So you know, this election's going to get decided by a couple hundred thousand people, swing voters, in five states. That's the target. That's the people you have to convince to win the presidency. And I say this with sadness, not anger, because I think Donald Trump was one of the greatest presidents in my lifetime. I think that in office his accomplishments were second to none. I mean, from the Abraham Accords to taking out Qasem Soleimani, to the economy, to
tax reform.
Go through the list. He's one of the most accomplished presidents. He has alienated the people. The reason he's not a two-term president is because two-term presidents go out and convince people who didn't vote for you the first time to vote for you the second time, and he did the opposite.
But the one thing that's happening, if he finds a way to survive these cases, and if they're put off till after the election, he has done almost the impossible again. These cases, the aggression, the pure politics that are involved in it, Letitia James deciding that he inflated his worth, therefore when he paid off his loans, it wasn't right. He's got no debt. He's paid off all his loans. He's got nobody coming after him for anything. And yet, Letitia James, pure politics. Alvin Bragg, pure politics. I could argue that Jack Smith's aggression he's as over his skis as he was with Menendez, Edwards, as well as McConnell of Virginia. And then you have this ridiculous suit in with 19 people in Georgia. And people are going, yeah, I didn't want to see Trump again, but I resent this. And I think that's the one thing when we were having these conversations after the midterms, I didn't anticipate.
But here's the thing. So I resent it too. I think they're weaponizing the justice system. Two things can be true at the same time, that they are weaponizing the justice system against Donald Trump and that Donald Trump did things that gave them the pretext to do that. So walk with me through an alternate history of the last 3 years. Donald Trump presides over a smooth transition, doesn't accept that he lost, but invites Biden to the White House, attends the inaugural, and it gives a farewell speech in which he says, like MacArthur, I'll be back in 4 years. And then he goes to Georgia, and instead of trying to turn around the election results there, holds the Senate in Republican hands. And as a result, Biden can't spend $5 trillion. And then he goes out and recruits people in the midterm elections. And when he finds out that he has classified information, he does what Mike Pence did and hands it back. And then he goes out and he wins the midterms for Republicans by recruiting people who could actually win races. All of a sudden, he would be up right now by 20 points, and it would be heading towards a landslide victory.
There'd be no 100%, 100%.
There would be none of this. None of this could be.
Yep, we'll say we might have lost him.
Yes, they hate him. Yes, they're mistreating him, but he makes it easy for them. And I don't want to spend the next year talking about Donald Trump. I want to talk about Joe Biden and why he has to be out of office. And with all these cases going on, all we're going to be talking about is the 2020 election and Donald Trump.
All right, so what changed when you saw 8 on the stage without Donald Trump? What do you think changed after that this week and as we get set for the Dana Perino-Stuart Varney debate at the end of September?
So I think that Nikki Haley did a really good job, and I think she emerged. I think Ron DeSantis did himself some good. If you look at the polls, his support increased a little bit, and his favorables went up. I think what's got to happen here is you've got to winnow the field. So basically there are two primaries going on. There's the primary to take on Trump, and then there's the primary against Trump. And every debate, we should be increasing the threshold that it takes to get there. So the first debate, it was 1%, and that knocked out a couple of people who shouldn't have been on the stage. There were still too many people on that stage. I think in the next debate, we should have fewer. It should be 3%. I think they're saying it's 3%. It should be 5% polling. And then the next debate, 7%. And the next debate, 10%. And eventually, you got to get it down to two people, and we got to decide between those two people. And then you have one person going against Trump when we come in January. If you've got like 7 or 8 people on the ballot going against Trump, then he's going to win. It's done.
Well, that's where it is right now. We'll have to see if he gets out for that next debate. I think he might do it.
But in all of those states, he's at 42, 43, 44%, which means 56, 57, 58% of Republicans want somebody else. So it's a question of whether there is a electorate ready to nominate somebody else, but it's got to be one person. We can't have a crowded field.
Mark Thiessen, always interesting, great column, and will tell Vivek Ramaswamy that you will not be his Secretary of State. I'm going to tell him.
I will not be, and I don't think the chances of that being necessary are very high.
You'd have a hard time with those policies. Thanks, Mark. Enjoy Labor Day. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
It's fascinating, behind-the-scenes Republican conversation about Senator Tim Scott. Donors are very concerned about the fact that Senator Scott is 57 and single. They're saying, is there something we should know? The fact that he is a bachelor, and America hasn't had a bachelor president in more than a century, they're concerned that if they go all in on him, then in a very conservative party, that could suddenly be an issue. Because the answers so far about this from Senator Scott and from the campaign have been vague, what has that done? It's been just like in real life. It's made everyone just more curious about it. Axios is able to report this morning the Scott campaign now saying that Senator Scott will address this issue in the next couple weeks.
All right. That is Mike Allen of Axios, founder, talking about Mike Scott. I did hear that at the debate. People were asking me, analysts were telling me, why is Tim Scott not married? You know, people are asking that question in all communities. And I thought, well, it's none of your business. But then again, it is, because if you want to find out who's going to be in the Oval Office, you want to find out what goes on, you know. And I think at this point, it doesn't really matter. Do you think it matters?
Yes. And I mean, I understand his point. Like, donors want to know, is there going to be some surprise that comes out, right? I mean, right. If there's one thing to have your private, but, you know, you don't want some scandal to emerge in October of 2024.
But I mean, Republicans have embraced Caitlyn Jenner.
Yes.
I mean, that's the 1976
her life
gold
has been
motor winner.
Very transparent. I mean, you know, all of the relationships, you know,
right.
It's been on reality TV. So there's no surprise there.
Understood. So that's an interesting way to go. The other thing is that I found that I almost thought, and I think you know this, Nikki Haley has got some momentum. And I've always said that she's so much better than people think. Oh, she has no traction. She's been in there forever. But people just needed to put her on stage. Vivek Ramaswamy is the best thing to ever happen to Nikki Haley. Jemele Hill going after Nikki Haley, calling her a racist, best thing that could ever happen. I thought that when Tim Scott was called out, too, I think that's the best thing that happened to him. You need a foil. You need a reason to be passionate.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from 40th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, the home of illegal immigrants, this is the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to have John, we're going to have with us in a matter of moments. In fact, he might even be ready around now, John Roberts. He's getting set to host his show in a couple of hours, a big hit show with Sandra Smith on Fox News Channel. And he's also covered the White House for years, and he was stuck at CBS for the first two or three decades of his career, but he's so much happier now. But before we get to John Roberts of Fox, let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I can't wait for the Republicans to understand that they have a responsibility to work with President Biden and come up with a solution once and for all, because the American people have been talking about immigration for decades.
You believe this? She's blaming Republicans. What a joke. Embarrassing. New York overrun with illegal immigrants. Governor Hochul travels to the White House, and the president doesn't even find time to say hello. Leaves him with his chief of staff. This has cost this city, over the course of 3 years, $12 billion. We're getting 3,000 a week in, and so far 7,000 a day are once again streaming across our southern border. Minimum.
Number two.
So you're part of the 23% of adults who are not concerned about the president's ability to be president because of his age and stamina. I got it.
That's but, because you got to do is watch
but
him.
77%, watch him. But 77% of adults are worried.
20 million and counting. That's how much Donald Trump has raised since his mugshot was put public. And DeSantis impresses all by being the man in charge of the Florida hurricane. At the same time, calls grow for Joe Biden to say goodbye, as 70% of the country says he is too old. Count me in.
Number one.
This morning, we are learning some new details about what was going on behind the scenes at the Department of Justice after an IRS whistleblower came forward alleging federal prosecutors were giving first son Hunter Biden some special treatment.
Hunter, high man of influence. Now we see the son of the president was wielding power not only with the White House, the second man in charge, the vice president, but the State Department, John Kerry and Anthony Blinken. Yep, but his dad knew nothing about it. When they got together, only talked about the weather. John Roberts, co-anchor of America Reports, when we get together, we talk much more than just about the weather, and I'm willing to go under oath and admit that.
Well, you know, that's what happens when I get together with the most approachable radio host in the country.
He's mocking my intro guy.
Oh, I'm not mocking. I'm appreciating it. Right. That is an amazing slug line.
Do you want it?
Do I want that same slug line?
Yes.
No, I'd like to be the least approachable person. No,
you want to be left alone.
I'm kidding. Yeah. Don't come near me, please. I love meeting all of our fabulous Fox viewers just like you do.
I know. But on a side note, while you're on that, is it different meeting somebody that saw you on CBS as opposed to someone that sees you on Fox?
Yeah, it means that the people who saw me on CBS have phenomenal memories, because that was a long, long time ago, Brian, and I can't remember half of it.
No, I'm talking about when you were recognized, when you were at CBS.
Oh,
is it a different type of viewer?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, politically their leanings might be a little bit different, but, you know, nice folks are nice folks.
So I'm watching now a rally in New York City with the Democratic mayor who's fighting with the Democratic governor, and the Democratic governor shows up at the Democratic White House and can't get a meeting with the president about an issue that one would argue, since I'm with a journalist, one would argue was caused by this president. But they are now arguing for the right to get the 85,000 illegal immigrants in New York, give them the right to work. John, can you see a problem with that?
Well, I could see a problem for people who are citizens of this country or who are legal immigrants who can't find a job. The fact that it may be taken by somebody who's in this country illegally probably irks them. But I think in the overall, when we step back and take a view of this from the 30,000-foot level, it would appear that New York State, New York City, and to a large degree Chicago as well, and other cities are finally understanding what states like Texas and Arizona and Florida have been going through for decades. You know, to a large degree, northern tier states have been completely immune from this problem, whereas the southern states have been inundated by the influx of illegal migrants and having to deal with the logistical issues associated with that, as well as the financial issues. And now you take a look at this, you've got 100,000, I think, illegal immigrants who are populating New York City, which is a population of more than 7 million. So it's a tiny, tiny percentage, and yet it's bringing the city to its knees. So what has Governor Abbott, what has Governor Ducey, what has Ron DeSantis been going through trying to deal with the constant influx of illegal immigration? And have they been running to the White House to say, we need financial help? No, they've been running to the White House to say, please do something about this illegal cross-border migration. But they've been dealing with it for all of this time. And now New York is, running to the president, even though the president apparently won't meet with them, to say, it's your fault. You created this. You need to help us.
So it's pretty amazing. They're running for help. They want to stop the border, but they also want a lot of money. And they're just taking over a city, all our hotels, over 200-plus facilities. No city's been hit by this. Overall, if you wanted to get attention on a problem, it was genius for Abbott and, to a degree, DeSantis to start offering this to citizens, to illegal immigrants, and say, listen, you don't have to stay here. Which city you want to go? You want to go to New York? Hop on. And now they have to deal with it. And they're not even calling out Abbott anymore because they realize they're a sanctuary city and a right to shelter. So you have those two things on the books. You can't say anything.
All of this really does reinforce the notion that every state is now a border state. But you will recall that Eric Adams and Kathy Hochul and the former mayor of Chicago And I think mayors of some other cities, Gavin Newsom, of course, weighed in on this. We're roundly criticizing Greg Abbott and Doug Ducey and DeSantis for ferrying people from the south up to the northern tier states. But let's not forget that the federal government has been doing exactly the same thing for years. And whereas Abbott and DeSantis and Ducey did it in the full light of day with full transparency, sending buses to the Port Authority and other places, a few busloads of illegal migrants were dropped off right in front of our Fox Bureau here in Washington, D.C. The federal government was doing it under the cover of night with flights that would land at the White Plains Airport at 2 o'clock in the morning. These people would stealthily be put on buses and then shipped to God knows where. You know, the difference that the southern governors is making is that they're doing this in the light of day for everyone to see. They're getting pilloried for it, but they really are highlighting a problem that the federal government has been dealing with in exactly the same way for decades now.
So what is the strategy? You're great at looking two moves and three moves ahead. What is the strategy for this administration being that this is now a Democratic White House problem, a Democratic state problem? What are they going to do? Just ignore it until the election?
I don't see a solution. I don't see a plan. Mayorkas still gets up in front of Congress at every appearance and says the border is closed. Clearly, that's not the case. When you take a look at the border barrier in Lukeville, Arizona, which is right in the middle of the Tucson sector, you've got those floodgates that are welded open, and hundreds of migrants are pouring across through that fence and through those holes every day, many of them with the assistance of smugglers on the Mexican side. Did anybody from the administration come forward and say, you know what, maybe we should open and close those gates, given the forecast for the day, if there's no rain in the forecast for a few days, close the gates, stop the cross-border traffic, then open them back up again? Now, Ron Vitello did say that logistically it's a little difficult to do that. But what's worse, having to dispatch people to open and close the gates or leaving them open for thousands of migrants to flow through? I don't want to say it puts the lie to, but it is in stark contradiction with what Mayorkas says about the border being closed.
And, John, I know you got a few hours to the show starts. You got to go move with the news. But you want to tease what's coming up?
We have got so much coming up, Brian, that you wouldn't believe it. We are by far the most approachable news program on the Fox News Network. We're going to be talking about a lot of things, particularly legally dealing with Hunter Biden. Bill Barr is going to be here to talk about that. Carrie Kupek as well, who, of course, was Bill Barr's spokesperson at the Department of Justice. She is now our legal analyst. And we're going to be talking about the case of a lacrosse coach, the head women's lacrosse coach at Oberlin College, who came out in support of the swimmer who finished second to Leah Thomas, and now says that she has been pilloried by the college, called transphobic. The team is angry at her just for coming out and supporting women in sports. So that'll be an interesting topic to go over today.
Make sure if you use some of my Shokin stuff to see if Bill Barr knew that Shokin claims that he was fired for one reason, and that was about to investigate Burisma, because that was when he was attorney general. Bill Barr will make news with John Roberts today. John, thanks so much. The show starts for 2 hours from 1 to 3. John Roberts will be there.
It's always great, Brian, to be able to approach you and not get the back of your hand.
Yes, because I have a temper. Go get him, John Roberts. Back in a moment. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Eric Adams, the New York mayor, is saying about these migrants in New York City, any plan that does not include stopping the flow at the border is a failed plan. So why aren't you guys stopping the flow at the border?
We are stopping the flow at the border. If anything, what the president has been able to do on his own without the help of Republicans in Congress, something that he had to do on his own again because Republicans refuse to give the funding necessary to deal with a situation.
That is, she's not even good. She's not even bending the truth. She just makes things up. Democrats have passed nothing at the border. at all on immigration. Zero. In fact, has he made a priority? All they did was make us more vulnerable, get rid of all the Remain in Mexico policies, get 20,000 Mexican Marines off their southern border, not deal with any of the Central and South American countries which people are crossing into in order to get here. Offering, remember, Trump was threatening sanctions, was threatening tariffs against El Salvador, the Triangle countries, and others. John Levine coming up. We'll talk a little bit about Hunter. But immigration is hot right now. There's a rally in New York City because it by far outside the border cities. I know if you're listening in Texas and Arizona, New Mexico and California don't complain, but I'm sure it's a mess there. But they don't complain because this is looked at as a hit on the administration. So now New York thinks their answer to their problems would be first getting men out of the free food and drink and laundry game after 30 days and then letting them work. Here's Mayor Eric Adams, cut 22.
Right now we are at a disagreement. I need the national government, the federal government, to both houses to come up with a real immigration reform package. I need the issues that we pointed out. And the governor has made it clear that she believes this is something that is basically New York City. We just disagree on that. New York City has run out of room. Any plan that does not include stopping the flow at the border is a failed plan.
That is true. But don't say because Republicans aren't working with Democrats. The first thing the House did is had their meeting at the border, and not one Democrat showed up. Here is Kathy Hochul talking about whose responsibility it is and trying to get them to be able to work here. Cut 24.
I can't wait for the Republicans to understand that they have a responsibility to work with President Biden, to work with Democrats in the House and Senate, and come up with a solution once and for all, because the American people have been talking about immigration for decades and they want answers. But I can't wait for that. I have to deal with the crisis in our state.
Yeah, you can't wait for that. And they've done nothing for that. They won't even meet with you. And they claim you keep asking for money and you say, I need money. But they claim you're wasting the money they're giving you. So, by the way, it's just like watching your neighbor's family fight in front of you. They're not even on your lawn, but in the middle of it. Can you imagine them yelling out and blaming you while they're beating each other up? That seems to be what this family, this Democratic family, is doing. Now, Sheriff Mark Lamb opened my eyes to something else. Some people believe that these cities are trying to solve their shortfall by claiming poverty when it comes to illegal immigrants and hoping to get it from the government. Cut 26.
These liberals, they just want to pad their pockets even more. And I guarantee you, even if they got the funding from the federal government that this governor is asking for, after they said they were a sanctuary city and got what they deserved, even though I don't want it to happen to any American city, they're going to take that money and give it to NGOs, non-governmental organizations. A lot of that money doesn't necessarily trickle down to fixing the problem. All it does is go to just furthering the problem. And then they're going to come back and say, well, if we just had a few more billion dollars, we could fix it.
And that's why I did not know, but I was listening to Congressman Lawler. He said that the number's gone from 59 to 84,000. They were starting to get it below 50, but now the people start surging again. If you give people jobs, as well as give them three meals a day, a menu, and laundry service, don't tell me that giving them a job is not going to make things worse. Of course, they're going to stream across. That's why I fought Catholic Charities, too. We're here to help people. Fine. But are you helping people? Because of those 10 people you help, you're now responsible for 40 because the word comes out that you're helping them. And the types of dangers they put themselves in or their kids in as they send them with coyotes for a better life to get to your sanctuary for Catholic Charities is too much. You have to think bigger than, well, this person came to my door with scraped knees starving. I get it. But there's going to be 25 more and then 2,500 in a month if word comes out that that's what they get if they come. And now we're up to 7,000 a day. So far, in July, there were 183,000 border encounters, In June, it was 144,000. They sense with the end evaporation of Title 42 that that number is going to go significantly down because of the new programs they had in place. And in the beginning, it did. But now it's ratcheting up big time. Big time. So that's going to be an issue in New York and these blue states, I believe, that would force, I don't know, some of these seats to flip. So it's just amazing. More from Kathy Hochul. She talked a lot about fixing the border, which he's never, as far as I could tell, has never been to. Cut 25.
A lot has to happen at the border. Okay. A lot has to happen at the border. I mean, we're still experiencing 3,000 coming to New York alone a week. I said, what's the end game here? What we can manage. We can put up a shelter to take care of 2,000 people at enormous cost. And I know the frustration of New Yorkers who are seeing something that they never expected. You know, there's soccer fields being used for migrants and community centers and facilities in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, we wasted all this money. That's why people are leaving, because you welcome them in and make them more important than everybody else. And that's why 19,000 students living in temporary housing have enrolled in city schools already, typically 2 months to 18 years. What's the big difference with these illegal immigrants? The big difference is that they don't have to get vaccinated. They don't have to speak the language. I imagine we're going to give them all their supplies. I just would like to say, if we're going to be supporting organizations and countries, can we have a say in it? Because right now, come one, come all. I agree. Congressman Maliotakis writes that it's time for Staten Island to secede from New York City, be its own state, and get two senators of their own. It's mostly Republican. The mayor doesn't want it, so let them split out. Count me in.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Well, I think there's consensus in our conference now that we're going to have to go to impeachment inquiry. Obviously, that'll be Speaker McCarthy's call, but I feel like we're there now, Sean. I feel like that's imminent. And I believe that that will be a tool in our toolbox when we go to court with our subpoena. Look, we've requested these documents. The House Oversight Committee has legislative jurisdiction over the National Archives. They've stonewalled us in the Biden mishandling of classified documents. Now they're, you know, we hope they don't stonewall us in the pseudonym request. Yeah. There's 5,400 emails.
But they are, and it's been over a year since they requested from the National Archives the three pseudonym addresses of the former vice president turned president Joe Biden. And they said, yeah, there's a lot of them. We'll get them to you when we can. Most of them are schedules. Really? Because a couple of them are something to do with Turkey. And believe it or not, Hunter is CC'd in them. John Levine has been all over this. New York Post writer. He's been all over the Hunter Biden story that keeps on giving. First off, James Comer saying impeachment might be the best way to go. Is it?
Well, you know, apparently opening an impeachment inquiry allows you a lot of new investigative tools to continue the probe.
But some moderate Republicans are not on board yet, and that could be a disaster.
Well, right. You know, this they went through the same problem in 2018 when they impeached Trump, where there was a lot of Democrats, you know, champing at the bit to do that. But the frontline members in the swing states were kind of like, well, there really isn't a there, and there's nervous. And for a lot of vulnerable Republicans now, there is similar nervousness where they say, well, we can't. There's really no smoking gun tying Joe Biden to any specific crime. So there's nervousness. And there isn't a smoking gun tying Joe Biden specifically to any crime that I can name right now. But there is an enormous amount of smoke that perhaps bears further inquiry. And there is the obvious question of that he lied to the American people when he said he never had any involvement in his son's overseas business dealings, which begs the additional question of why would he lie in this way? What was he trying to cover up here?
So now we find out there's correspondence with John Kerry's office, Hunter Biden, John Kerry's office.
Right. The entire federal government was leveraged to service Hunter Biden's, you know, businesses overseas. There was talk. I mean, if you look at the Romania case where he was trying to get that convicted criminal to his charges to go away, he's living in exile
oligarch
in England now. Yeah. Papaviciu, I think is his name. He was leveraging the U.S. embassy in Romania for contacts. And there was a lot of emails between him and the Romanian ambassador, close Biden friend. And he was very able to seamlessly leverage the U.S. government to integrate it into his businesses. And I think that alone is something that I think could merit an impeachment inquiry.
So Daily Mail has that story with some emails that show, number one, that Victor Nuland, Victoria Nuland, the whole letter, not just excerpts, was praising Shokin for how good he was doing. Keep it up. I know it's hard, but it's not insurmountable with the exact words. Also, it shows Hunter was maneuvering with David Boyce's law firm in order to help save the CEO of Burisma and put pressure internationally. Why would Hunter be getting involved with things like that and the term DC used instead of the vice president?
I think Viktor Shokin is at the heart of all of this stuff. And you did a fabulous interview with him. And I worry for his safety.
He worries for his safety.
And he should worry because he is at the heart of all this stuff. He was investigating Burisma. We know Devin Archer told the House Oversight Committee that Burisma wanted Shokin gone. Get rid of this investigation. He says, Hunter called back to D.C. Who is D.C.? Come on. And then all of a sudden, Shokin is gone. You have Biden bragging about forcing him out or threatening to hold USAID. This is as close as you get. Really, it is. It's open and shut. Like he was acting on behalf of a foreign company and influencing U.S. foreign policy on behalf of a foreign company because his son sat on the board. That's it. And then you've got the addition to that, the FBI document where the head of Burisma is joking about how he has audio tape recordings of Hunter and Joe and Leverage, and he's paying them both off. And this is not some Steele dossier oppo file. This is a credible FBI source provided this information.
So here is Viktor Shokin saying, and this is why this is key, because they say Viktor Shokin was not pursuing Burisma that would have hurt Hunter's interests. He got fired and was told to be fired because he was not prosecuting crimes in the transition from Poroshenko to Yanukovych after the election. Right. But Viktor Shokin says that is wrong. Listen, cut four.
I have no doubt that there were illegal activities engaged in by Burisma. As a matter of fact, the criminal case had been started before me. It continued to expand. And Zlochevsky, who at the time held the post of minister and was the founder and CEO of Burisma, started bringing in people who could provide protection for him. Hunter Biden was among them. And the corruption network expanded as a result. So, yes, to answer your question, there's no doubt in my mind that Burisma was engaged in illegal activities.
You know, something in your interview that I liked a lot was when Shokin said, they always say I'm corrupt. He's a corrupt prosecutor. We had to fire that corrupt prosecutor. What single example of corruption can any of you point to? And it's like, I'm thinking, I was like, you know what? There's nothing. It's one of the things that just gets said. You're saying, well, he didn't prosecute people. That's not really corruption.
Right.
Like, we have a prosecutor in New York that doesn't prosecute people all day long for a living. Like, you know, that's not a fireable corruption offense.
You want a more aggressive. So what I did is on those stories, they had the headlines of corrupt prosecutor fired. So I put the headlines in the story, but I read the stories. And all it would say is, you know, he's corrupt.
Corrupt.
And the corrupt, as people know, internationally known as corrupt.
Yeah.
Okay, but what? And so I said to him, why don't you sue for defamation? He said, you need money to sue. Yeah. I'm living on a fixed income, and I get roughly $800 a month to live here in a war zone, and I've been killed, tried to be killed twice at the end of this. He said, I have a book to write. Do you know a publisher? And do you know anybody that can provide security for me? It was unbelievable. We were off the air, basically, and he asked that.
Right.
As just a guy.
I think... He is someone that we should provide some kind of asylum to. If obviously the current administration probably
have
is not
no
going to pursue
that.
But if there is a change of leadership in Washington and the White House, that's got to be a priority, is making sure Shokin is safe and protecting him, because he's really a heroic figure. He's a whistleblower. We still don't know what is true, what isn't true, but from the looks of it, he was trying to do the right thing. There was major corruption at Burisma that he was investigating. There was major wrongdoing. And you know, Hunter was clearly on the board to provide a gateway point to the father. He had no relevant energy experience. The FBI file makes this very, very clear. So, you know, right off the bat, you know, Burisma is clearly a shady company for doing such a thing.
So Hunter Biden's law firm exchanged 1,000 plus emails with Joe's VP office. Now, that firm was Rosemont Seneca. I think there's a story here in John Kerry's son was a partner in that. And out of nowhere, he left Devin Archer and Hunter alone.
Yeah.
Now, did he find sense that his dad said, what are you doing? You're going to make – I'm Secretary of State. Get out of there, like the vice president should have done? Did he just say to himself, I want to backpack through Europe and I can't do that when I have a full-time job? But John Kerry was asked to speak at Hunter Biden's class. I didn't know Hunter Biden was a professor at Georgetown. I didn't know that. So he said, this correspondent saying, would you come and speak? And he's like, I want to go do this. So he had a relationship with the Secretary of State. Father is Vice President of the United States. He's got this international business going. No wonder people are trying to hire him.
I think John Kerry is an undersung part of this whole story. And as the investigation continues to expand, you may see more questions coming to him. You know, can you explain everything you just said? And I think maybe he said to his son, get out now while you still can. But look, Kerry was a U.S. senator. He was Secretary of State. He ran for president. And he, I believe, does he still have that job in the White House? He's like a climate.
Yeah,
he's like a
climate. He just met with China.
Czar, yeah. So he's still a very relevant figure in the U.S. government. And I think, yeah, there's probably a lot of grounds to bring him in for questioning to sort of figure out what we know, what we don't know.
John Kerry was one of the first established senators, politicians, to endorse Joe Biden, even when he was losing. So there's loyalty there, and there's probably some payback involved. So another name is coming up, and Comer's ready to bring him back. Cut two.
I expect to see Tony Bobulinski in front of an oversight committee hearing very soon. I think he wants to tell his story, and I know the American people want to hear the story. So we're definitely going to hear from Bobulinski very soon. With respect to Sherwin, we've been trying to communicate with Sherwin. But look, Sherwin's going to have to answer for all of these transactions. And where you referenced, Sean, where Hunter Biden was paying for things for Joe Biden in these accounts, these are the accounts we're now asking for. And these are the accounts we're probably going to head to court in the very near future to try to obtain.
And Sherwin was the – tell me, John Levine, why you think Sherwin's important.
Well, there's two names there. I mean, I love Tony Bobulinski, but we've heard a lot from Tony Bobulinski already. And I hope if he has any new information to provide, that's great. But the real money name there is Eric Schwerin. Eric Schwerin was the CEO of Rosemont Seneca, which is Hunter Biden's investment firm. But he basically acted as sort of a CFO of the Biden family office, right? He handled all of Hunter Biden and Joe Biden's money, and a lot of times their accounts were commingled. He had access to Joe Biden's tax returns. He was very intimately involved in the president's personal finances, and he is a constant feature in the hard drive on emails between like 2009 to 2019, a full 10-year spread. He had his fingers in everything. He's the most consistent business partner. He, even more than Devin Archer, I think, knows everything. And he's the money guy, essentially. So Eric is the key to all this. Now, what I've heard, and if you believe the House Oversight Committee, and I do, he's cooperating with them, and he will eventually come in to testify. But, you know, I ask every single week. They're sick of hearing me. When is Schwerin coming in? When is Schwerin coming in? They say, John, it's happening soon. And we'll get that eventually. And I think there'll be some major bombshells from that guy.
And the question is, will he be honest? Because Archer's still holding back, in my view, because – hasn't been sentenced yet.
Archer's definitely holding back. So what is when Archer says Hunter would call back to D.C., that's not – what does that mean? Who is D.C.? He's definitely holding back.
So when you watch the interview he gave online, you see the grimaces and the giggles.
Yeah.
You know he's holding back because he could be looking at substantial time in jail for something totally separate.
Right.
It seems he seemed to have smuggled or swindled some Indian tribe out of their investment, which – do you have an ounce of integrity in you?
Archer is not a good guy. I mean, it's like, you know, birds of a feather, Hunter and Archer. So he separately swindled some Native American tribes out of millions of dollars, some terrible scheme, and he's going to prison for unrelated federal charges that relate to that. So, yeah, he obviously could say more. And Schwerin, look, he's someone who probably – he has his attorneys. He doesn't want to say anything that'll incriminate himself, obviously. He's not charged with anything as far as I know.
So John, the reason why Bobulinski matters now is because Bobulinski gave us so much so quickly. Right. We were like got hit in the face by a blizzard. And we said, okay, let me jot this down. Can you back this up? What do you mean he's the big guy? What do you mean you met him at the Beverly Hilton hotels behind a podium after hearing him speak? What do you mean that you were asked to – and then you got double-crossed by the – so everything was so new. But now everybody's getting the competency that you and Miranda have helped give everybody through the New York Post and others. And we got the competency. Now he comes in and we go, oh, okay, now I know what you mean. And he is the link – to say Joe. He's the one who Jim Biden said, don't ever bring up my brother. Don't ever put his name in anything. So to hear that publicly is right. almost similar to the whistleblowers coming out and going, David Weiss is screwing this up on purpose. And I'll tell you, I took real time, I memorialized this in real time. You gave me competency now. But if I got those IRS guys 2 years ago, they'd be like, Hunter, you know, Dave, what are you talking about? Now I get it.
Well, we've never heard from Bob Alinsky under oath, I'm pretty sure. He's only given interviews to the press, which so that matters, too, because now it's going to have the force of, you know, if it's a lie, it's perjury. And I do think it's good to remind the American people of everything he was saying. But I have a high bar for new information. And if he's going to come and testify, I think that's great. But I'm hoping he can provide more information than he's had so far. And he also has stuff, I think, that he's held back. And I'm hoping,
really? Okay.
I have a hunch.
Well, he's got to protect himself.
He's got to protect himself. I don't want everything about Hunter. It's wrapped up in so much, you know, potentially illegal behavior. A lot of these guys have to be careful they don't incriminate themselves. But I do think Bob Alinsky has more he could say than he's even said up till now.
And I go back and forth with him. I tried to get to the first interview, and he did the right thing going with Tucker, bigger show. But as I knew his wrestling contacts, I have a bunch of people that wrestled with him at Penn State, and they go, you know, he's a good guy. And he walked on, and he's an animal, and he's tough. And then you look at his background, he became a military officer and then a self-made multimillionaire. He did not need any of this.
No.
But he's a patriot. And he's concerned about the country. So all I can tell you is, if you're listening saying, I don't know anything about him, guys that I know extremely well, one I've known since second grade, tells me this guy is real and he's authentic and you don't want to fight him.
Yeah, no. I mean, I've had many dealings with him. He's always been a straight shooter, a rock solid guy. And, you know, I've never had any instance where I felt he was being untruthful.
All right, back in a moment. A couple more minutes with John Levine. For example, like, where's this heading? So John makes these big stories, puts them on Friday, and then I have to read this stuff over the weekend. I got nobody to talk to about it. I got to get to the bottom of that story in a moment.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
John Levine here with the New York Post. So, John, there's a few angles to go on here. You have to wonder what those 5,400 emails are saved from the National Archives. And just for the record, these are the same National Archives who were desperate to get those that top secret stuff back from Donald Trump to the point where they call the FBI. This is the same one that clearly has waited a year and a half to get them emails. If they were nonpartisan, they get the emails they requested.
Right. I mean, I think the idea that they're nonpartisan is pretty much out there.
I always thought before this, I thought archives were nonpartisan.
Right. No, it's shocking how the allegedly nonpartisan organs of the U.S. government have obfuscated and stalled. And it appears to be an effort to run out the clock, hope that Democrats take back the House and shut the whole thing down. I mean, the FBI is a great example of that as well. They fought to not release the document showing that Burisma had these recordings. So, the archives is partisan. They don't want to cooperate. And now we have the existence of these thousands of emails. And what do these say? And that's going to be another fight getting access to those. But I'm sure we will, because at the end of the day, these institutions have to be accountable to Congress. That's it.
Here's Kimberly Strassel of the Wall Street Journal, Cut 3.
Two very disturbing things about this email thing. One is that while the volume of email is new, the number that are sitting in the National Archives, we've actually known about these email addresses for 2 years. Senators Grassley and Johnson sent letters demanding information about those names, and they still have not been given access to them. So the White House is blockading that. The second thing is, you see there, those are private email addresses. Remember Hillary Clinton? How many of those did Joe Biden willingly send over to the National Archives, but how many didn't get sent back over in the end? Those are legitimate questions, too. If he was using government business on those accounts, can we be confident that there's a full record of everything that happened on those accounts?
Government business on private accounts. Where have we heard that before?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a big problem.
What about the explanation given? Why are you using aliases? Yeah. Well, to throw off the Chinese? Really? We can't protect the vice president and president from the Chinese's emails?
If it's also innocent, then just put the emails out. You know, if there's classified material, which, by the way, that would be a whole other can of worms. But if there's anything that's that sensitive that we can't see, but they're saying it's just calendars and nothing, release the emails. Again, sunlight is the best disinfectant. What are they trying to hide? It just looks suspicious when they're not straight with the American people.
Irony. This is what Rudy Giuliani was pursuing. In a way, William Barr, if he was pursuing it as Department of Justice, they would have been somewhat suspicious because Joe Biden potentially would be another rival, political rival. But this is the story that Rudy was trying to get at.
These emails will be very important, and they will be released.
And will you have a column out over the weekend, or is Labor Day a time in which everyone's at the beach?
I'm working. I'm going to have stuff this weekend.
You will?
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're not going to tip me off again?
Nope. You'll have to read it in the paper.
Thanks, John. Kinda.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. This is the final hour of the Brian Kilmeade Show just this week. Matt Whitaker is standing by, and then Tyrus. Two punishing, great athletes, by the way. Matt Whitaker, a college football player. Tyrus, also a college football player who went wrestling, just retired. And now we're going to just dial up the intellectual level. Neither one of these men have to throw people around anymore. So before we get to them, let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
I can't wait for the Republicans to understand that they have a responsibility to work with President Biden and come up with a solution once and for all, because the American people have been talking about immigration for decades.
Kathy Hochul disingenuously blaming Republicans for what's happening at the border. Stop laughing for a second. Let me finish. Embarrassing. New York is overrun with illegal immigrants. Governor Hochul travels to the White House. The president is there and sends his chief of staff. He doesn't even come by to say hello. My goodness, it's cost this city $12 billion over the last 3 years since he took over. And he does not provide the money, but does provide the illegal immigrants. I got to give him that.
Number two.
You're part of the 23% of adults who are not concerned about the president's ability to be president because of his age and stamina. I got it.
That's because what you got to do is watch
but
him.
77%, watch him. But 77% of adults are worried.
Watch him? Yeah, we've been watching him. It's a horror show. 20 million and counting. That's how much Trump has raised since his mugshot went public, as well as Ron DeSantis not raising money, but showing he can lead by how well he did just that with Florida and the hurricane. At the same time, calls grow for Joe Biden to say goodbye as he ages before our eyes.
Number one.
This morning, we are learning some new details about what was going on behind the scenes at the Department of Justice after an IRS whistleblower came forward alleging federal prosecutors were giving first son Hunter Biden some special treatment.
There you go. Mark Meredith helping us out. Hunter, high man of influence. Now we see that he was corresponding with the Secretary of State, John Kerry. Yep, his dad knew nothing about his overseas business operations. Never came up. But did he call into business meetings to talk about the weather, too, with John Kerry? I don't think so. With me right now is Matt Whitaker. Hey, Matt, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Brian. Good to be with you.
Well, first off, on the President of the United States publishes a mugshot and gets $20 million. Both scenarios I never thought I would say out loud, but it happened.
Yeah, well, two thoughts on that is, first of all, you know, this was the left's desire. You know, they were so disappointed in the first three indictments that they weren't able to get that that iconic mugshot. They finally got it, and obviously it's blown up in their face. I mean, that, you know, I know people that are, you know, getting the New York Post, the front page, and getting that frame, putting up in their house as a work of art. So, you know, obviously Trump and, you know, President Trump and his supporters think that he has been wrongly targeted. I've never seen the use of prosecutorial assets and investigative assets targeted at one citizen ever in the history of the United States of America. So this is not only unprecedented, you know, that word just doesn't seem to do it justice as we talk about these things. But, you know, obviously the president's supporters, a small dollar, ordinary Americans that know his policies work for them are rallying.
Matt, my question is going to reveal I didn't go to law school. So a lot of most of my audience, I don't feel as guilty. But first off, we know 19 people are going to be tried. And if the prosecutor has her way, Fannie Willis, all at once. Well, they've already severed one off. He is now doing his own thing. And now we want another one. Eastman says, I want to do my thing. And then Fannie Willis goes, I want everyone tried in October. who ultimately will decide if this happens and who gets severed, Cheeseborough gets severed or not?
Yeah, well, because you have a bunch of lawyers who are giving advice to a client, you know, that's going to be very complicated in trying to navigate that. And, you know, I think one of the things about law school is you need to appreciate, Brian, is all you have to do is be able to read a lot at the end of the
and
day.
And you get it.
But, you know, that being said, I think this, you know, Fannie may have a desire to, you know, get this case resolved in the easiest way possible, which is all at the same time. But because of the conflicting interests and the, you know, the advice of counsel defense that ultimately will be the center of this for President Trump and most likely people like Mark Meadows, who took the advice of people, you know, like Rudy Giuliani and Eastman and others, I think you're going to see this start to string out kind of like a a logistics caravan will string out. And so I think you're going to see these start to happen in drips and drabs, and everybody's going to want to go or after the next person. And so I think you're going to see the timeline really get extended over the course of the next month or two.
Timeline for everyone or separately? Is that October date that Cheeseborough wants to go? Is he going to do that? Am I not to think that that's in stone?
Yeah. So obviously speedy trial is a right of the defendant. And so since Cheeseborough is a defendant, you know, he should be entitled to go when he wants to go. And the government's going to have a hard time arguing against that. But, you know, that is going to probably be the pivot point for a lot of these other cases. And if, you know, if they ultimately lose that case, for example, then, you know, the rest of them, you know, could be looked at under a new light. It's legally fascinating, but it's hard to predict because, you know, each defendant has their own unique rights, and whether they exercise those, especially speedy trial rights and other constitutional rights, is going to be up to them.
See, Matt, what I don't get is they all have different infractions. So how can you possibly try them all? You know, one wants to do delegates. The other one wanted to do January 6th. The other one accused. President Trump is accused of. Who knows what he's, I'm not going to get into it, but you know, his phone call, where he wants to go find votes or whatever you want, but they're all did different things.
Yeah, they did. And this is, I think the challenge with a RICO conspiracy is trying to put all these disparate acts under the umbrella of the RICO conspiracy. I think it's a very aggressive strategy that she has chosen. It's no one's ever done this in the context of politics or political law. And then remember, there's an overarching constitutional right to free speech. And so, you know, you certainly have an ability, as the president did when he called Raffensperger, to call a secretary of state up. And then the jury is going to have to decide whether that, you know, was a criminal act or whether he was just calling saying, hey, I'm down 11,000 votes. And, you know, there's a lot of irregularities in Georgia. And so fine. This is going to be up to a jury. I think for me, Brian, the speedy trial issues are interesting. Who goes first is interesting. But I think the most interesting issue is whether this gets removed to federal court, because that changes the whole complexion. You get a different judge. You'll get a different jury pool, a broader jury pool, much more likely to pick people that are sympathetic to Donald Trump and his and the people that were involved in 2020 election. So there's a lot of moving parts. I'm always going to be willing to come on your show because I love doing the show, Brian.
Former Acting Attorney General Matt Whitaker with us. So, Matt, Meadows goes out there, the tip of the spear. He testified for about 4 hours about why he needs to go to a federal court. But they started trying the case a little bit, ask him why he did certain things. And I'm saying to myself, wait a second. I just thought they were just going to present the reason why they think it's a federal case. He was chief of staff. He was president of the United States. This all happened when the president was president of the United States. It was about a federal election. So instead, they start asking him why he did certain things, how he dealt with Trump. Were you surprised all that came up?
Yeah. So I've been in that chair. I've been a prosecutor with a defendant on the stand in a preliminary pretrial hearing on a particular issue. There's a scope issue. And obviously, the defense lawyer probably should have done a better job of objecting to the line of questioning on scope. But it was pretty clear to me, you know, sort of understanding what was happening, is that they were happy for him to tell his story. Now, that's inconsistent, Brian, with typical defense counsel advice, is which you don't want your client to tell their story more than once. But be here or there, I think they obviously wanted to get Mark Meadows' narrative out there, and they were happy to not object to the scope issue of that line of questioning. Now, you know, obviously the whole ball of wax for Mark is going to be whether or not he was acting in the confines of his role as chief of staff. I think it's pretty clear he was acting in that role. He was serving the president. It's a very broad latitude as to what you do in the capacity as chief of staff. And so this is again, unprecedented. So this case, at least as it relates to Mr. Meadows, is going to twist and turn through the appeals court, because whatever the judge decides, and you know, whether to remove it to federal court or not, that's going to be reviewed by appellate courts that will probably be much more favorable to his arguments.
Last question about this. And that is, mm-hmm. if Mark Meadows gets through to federal court, you see Fannie Willis appealing?
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Okay,
it gets appealed either way.
So if he goes to federal court, does that help the other 18 go there too?
Maybe. It's always an interesting tension between state and federal courts because, you know, you're dealing with dual sovereigns, you know, under a constitutional system. And if one isn't willing to relent, if the state court is wanting to hold on to the case or some of the defendants, certainly the prosecutor is, that's going to present a challenge. Obviously, the supremacy clause of the United States Constitution gives the federal courts the leg up to be the ultimate decider of that. But I don't think it's going to be as clean cut as maybe most lawyers like me would think it should be.
Okay, and we'll see what the timing goes with all that.
Yeah.
Why do you think it's important to find out if Willis and Jack Smith were talking to each other and coordinating?
Well, I think ultimately, if the prosecutors were sharing information and coordinating, it emphasizes the targeting of Donald Trump and his allies, and how they used the awesome powers of both state and federal government prosecutorial resources to target Donald Trump. And I think the American people need to understand kind of how desperate they were to squeeze everything out of the fact pattern and then decide who's going to take the cases.
Okay. I want to go to the civil court, civil trial. So Letitia James says, I don't need to go to court. It's so obvious that he inflated his income in order to get loans and buy things that he shouldn't have been eligible for, even though, and no one argues this, no bank says I have a complaint. Nobody has not gotten paid back with interest. They just decided he inflated his income. Because of that, we don't even want to have a trial. Let's work on the penalty phase. Trump says, I want to dismiss the whole thing. Matt Whitaker, analyze this case.
Yeah, she's not going to be able to just unilaterally make a factual statement and then get to the penalty phase on that. That's not the way due process works under our system, Brian. When you have real estate assets or you have illiquid assets, I mean, obviously what their valuation, if you're going to get a loan, the court, you know, the bank would ask you what they're valued at, and you state a number. If the bank disagrees with you, they can obviously get an appraisal. They can obviously do their own due diligence. So I think this case just really is way aggressive for, you know, what she's allowed to do under the law. And I think, she obviously campaigned on getting Trump, and that's what she's trying to do.
She's trying to bankrupt him. She's trying to make it. And some of the things have been thrown out there that we will liquidate your assets and prevent you from ever doing business again. So they'll take his buildings, his golf courses. Who knows what else, what other interests that he has, although he puts his name on everything. It's hard to see where he'd be a minority owner anywhere, and just prevent it from doing business in New York again. I mean,
it sounds a little bit like the tyrants we revolted against in 1776, doesn't it?
Which, by the way, they had no problems with Trump when previous administrations begged him to buy a rink and fix it in Central Park. Another one, Bloomberg begged him to revitalize the Bronx golf course. Everybody wanted his money when they were looking to run for office. But this same guy now is being targeted by people who see pure politics in this. It bothers me that our system could be abused like this. I don't care what you think of Trump. They clearly are targeting for political reasons somebody they don't like. That should not be possible.
Yeah, Brian, I couldn't have said it better myself, and I completely agree with you. It is extraordinary how New York City took advantage of Donald Trump and then you know, now they're trying to, you know, to put them out of business. It's just, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, you point out some of the things that he did for the city and for the state, and it's just, you know, it just shows you that the politicians on the left can't be trusted.
And Matt, is this why people, a lot of them, do deals? They might be innocent. They feel they have a shot, but they can't afford the attorney fees, though their business going into hock, their lives going on hold, so they cut deals. They're trying to wear this guy out.
Yeah, sometimes the process is the penalty, and you're seeing that in this case. You're seeing so much of the weight of the government being used to, you know, twist him and make him spend a lot of money to defend against a lot of spurious accusations.
All right, Matt, we'll see if he gets the nomination, wins, and see if he gets Matt Whitaker as Attorney General. See if he can afford you. Matt Whitaker,
Appreciate it.
You got
see
it.
You soon. Bye-bye.
All right, meanwhile, when we come back, your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Brian Kilmeade Show.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
She had an answer on abortion that a lot of Republicans said, that's a practical answer that is better than what the party's been saying a lot of times on that. And so I'm hearing that there's a lot of Republican donors who are offering to hold events for her. And when you're in a candidate in a crowded field this far out, there's no call you'd rather get than someone that, from a donor, someone with a lot of money and or a lot of friends. And funnily enough, a lot of people with a lot of money have a lot of friends who want to do an event from you. From Democrats, I'm hearing that they say if somehow Nikki Haley, if she could get past Trump, if she somehow became the Republican nominee, and there's no numerical way to see how that happens now, but if that happens, that she could be a very strong opponent for Biden. So there are Democrats who say, I would not want President Biden to have to face Ambassador Haley in a general.
That is Mike Allen of Axios talking about the increasingly good fortunes of Nikki Haley. John in California. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
No problem. What's in your mind?
I know you have a direct speed dial to Trump, so I wanted you to give him the new nickname for Joe Biden. It's Quid Pro Joe. We got to get rid of that crook, the retread of the crooked Joe. The other thing I wanted to talk about was the strategy by the Republicans in Congress. They really need to take their time and drip out information as it comes, because I think if they move too quickly, they're going to get another candidate in there if they're not already planning it already. And I know Gavin Newsom has a terrible record, but no matter what he does in this state, he's destroying this state, and they still got a 60% approval rating. So don't underestimate, just based on his terrible record, his capability of winning against Trump or any other Republican.
Yeah, he's
that's
got
it. That's my view on it.
Because he's much more talented, but he's a terrible chief executive, and he stands for nothing. He ruined San Francisco, and now he's ruining the state. But like you said, I did not know he has 60% approval rating, even though he was almost recalled a couple of years in. So as the smash and grab becomes a daily thing in Los Angeles and San Francisco and major businesses leave, he is probably more formidable than Joe Biden. I know what you're saying. But Republicans, you say, should just death by a million cuts. Don't just take him out.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
One more time, Jimmy.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Fallon.
I'm Stephen Colbert.
I'm Jimmy Kimmel. I thought when you said Jimmy, you meant me, Jimmy, but you meant Jimmy, Jimmy.
I always mean you.
But when you say Seth Meyers, who do you mean?
I mean John Oliver.
It's the five of us together for maybe an hour a day.
Strike Force 5 is the name of our podcast. Subscribe to it now.
So the five talk show hosts who don't have a job because of the writer's strike, Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert, John Oliver, and Seth Meyers have gotten together, put together a podcast. So I just saw Tyrus at the App Store. We go there all the time. And he was downloading the app to know they get the podcast. And I said, Tyrus, you want to come on and talk about it? Because you're in late night television with the number one show at Gutfeld. Tyrus is here. Tyrus got that memoir out. He's got a new book he's working on, too. But he's got a memoir that gives you an idea how he got to where he is today. What's your reaction to the five guys getting together just to talk?
You know, I always support you, but you were just completely dishonest with the American people. We go to the App Store, you and I. We go for video games and stuff. Let's be honest. All right? This is the first I've heard of it. Really? And I said, what do you mean, really?
They want to raise money. They want to raise money.
Yeah. The five of them get together. How long will those egos last? I mean, I get it. But even – I always think when stuff like that comes together, it's like it's out of desperation. Obviously, they want the strike to be over. I guess I never heard of improv. But and get back to work. But it's a nice attempt, I think. Together, you know, if they film it, maybe – they can give us a little run for our money. But.
So, Tyrus, this is a couple of things. Did you watch late night television at all growing up?
Oh, of course. I mean, I watched Johnny Carson. Right. I watched Letterman.
Arsenio was good.
Arsenio was like, hey, we could do this too. And, you know, and
Bill Clinton famously played the saxophone. He used to be where things happened.
He had that. And then, of course, Jay Leno was good. And so. You watched it as much as I could, you know, being in school and stuff. You know, it was only like Friday nights. But and then I watched more of the old Carson stuff because that's when it was just funny. When he had like Don Rickles on there and he had Sammy Davis Jr. on there and they had the great TV actors from that day.
It would be so much be unscripted.
Oh, it would just
everything
be,
now
just
is
go.
Such a promo.
Well, they can't work because no one to write their jokes for them. I think that should say a lot to the fans. You know, that should be like, you know, the stuff they say, they're just reading a teleprompter. So really, the ones you miss are the writers.
Right.
So maybe the writers should get paid more.
If I remember correctly, Leno, when they went on strike, took a week off and they said, I'm going to go back. I'm going to write my own stuff. He was writing his own monologues.
Yeah, because he was talented.
And he's a workhorse.
He's a workhorse. Like, you know, you think Carson would ad-lib, you know, but I guess the other side of it, it's a show of solidarity. That we won't work while we're supporting. But then they go out and they do a podcast, so they are kind of working.
So this is what bothers me. The history of television is competition. Today's show, Good Morning America, Carson, Joey Bishop, you know, you, Dick Cavett. And he stopped talking to you. Don Rivers, they never talked again. You going to come against me? I'm never talking to you again. Letterman and Leno fractured the friendship. Oh, really? Yeah. You got the Tonight Show over me? I'm doing my own thing. Those are the days. That's America.
Right.
You going to compete with me? These guys don't compete.
They don't compete.
They actually swap shows.
I guarantee you if any of them was in first place, it'd be different. Let me tell you what we did. Let me tell you what the Gutfeld did because we, for whatever reason, don't get invited to the Emmys, right? Probably because we don't cut the check.
Right.
But they knew better than to give the Emmy to the second best, which is probably Colbert. Colbert, I think, is the toughest competition we have. So instead of that, they gave it to John Oliver, which was the lowest rated show. So we
HBO
made
HBO once a week.
Yeah, we made the late night Emmy a participation award, and I am more prouder than that than I've actually winning an Emmy because we took the establishment and they gave it to the lowest rated show.
That's so interesting, yeah.
So that shows, although they pretend like we don't exist, but they weren't willing to give they weren't willing to admit they were going to have to take the silver. So I take that as, that in itself is when they won't show up, when they refuse to take second, you're in their head.
So a couple of things. I don't know where you were when Stephen Colbert first launched. He was getting zero ratings. The only reason he got ratings is because he just went all on the offense against Donald Trump.
Right.
Well, they wouldn't even split it. Like, if you watch Leno, sometimes they'll do this thing with Jimmy Fallon, where Jimmy Fallon says, you know, my calves bother me. I need a break. And he'll walk out. And Leno takes over out of respect.
Right.
And he'll come to his mouth. You know what he does? Immediately starts hitting both sides. And guess what happens? Both sides laugh.
Yeah.
Because it's an equal opportunity offender. Why do you see it ever coming back?
Because here's the deal. There's the Trump hysteria. There was a short-term spike in it. CNN went all in. All these media guys went in. All these journalists went in. And you look at the guys who were at the forefront of the attacking the Trump train. what's his name on CNN. Don Lemon went hard in the paint. So did Acosta.
Jay Tapper.
Jay kind of does the thing where he'll say something and then kind of like apologetically back out of it. But Acosta went all in. He was all in. He was his nemesis. He hassled
rude
him
as hell.
Could just nonstop. And when it was over, wow, you've been in the gym, huh, bro?
Did you see that?
Just, wow.
He just ripped the microphone off.
Acosta really bothered you. But
no, it's okay. It's okay, Eric. We can wait till the break.
And
look at that.
But once it was over, he went away. They gave him a show. It tanked out. You know, that's the thing. They all went in because, you know, Fallon had that great bit with Trump, President Trump's hair. And he caught so much hell for it. But everyone was laughing. He had everybody.
It was funny. Made,
and they bet on the half the country. But they realized that the other half of the country who works and comes home at night, those are the ones who are sitting and watching 11 o'clock to laugh and go to bed. So they just basically kind of spit in the face of half the country, and then they are shocked that their numbers went in the tanks because the people they bet on, once the Trump thing was done, they didn't stay with him. They didn't come back. CNN is like battling with HLN.
So I was talking to Pierce yesterday, and he's friends with James Corden.
Yeah.
And James Corden had very creative stuff. Of course, he had to do his obligatory Trump's terrible. But he used to do plays. Like he used to stop traffic and do mini plays while the light was red and then come back. They used to do extraordinary things. But know what they said? The amount of money you're costing me to do this show, where Letterman used to thrive in that area, actually the exact same show, I'm not getting the ratings. So basically they can't afford him anymore. So he's like, I'll just go back to England. That things are changing right before our eyes.
Well, the thing is, here's what it is. When you come on at 12 midnight, the viewer is not trying to be scared or angered. They're trying to go to sleep with a smile on their face. And you want to make everybody laugh and happy. And plays on the road, I would rather hear than bashing a president that half the country voted for.
Right.
Like, there was no money and sense in it. And then some of his off-the-field stuff was a little weird. But again, it goes to the same thing where –
You mean in the restaurant when he blew up at people?
Yeah. You know, but you get into this thing where the best thing to do is make fun of everybody. The Don Rickles philosophy is what I live my life by. I make fun of Trump. I even occasionally, although I don't make fun of you because that's all Gutfeld does.
That's all he does.
My role is to be like, why?
Why?
Why? Show me he's a good guy, man. What are we doing here?
Like, right. And if you can't convince him.
I mean, I heard of shooting in the tent, but like throwing dynamite sticks in the tent is ridiculous.
Right.
I was shocked when Perino took a shot at you.
No way.
Yeah. And I was like, what are we? You too? Yeah. She took a shot
Allison,
at you.
Was I not informed of this? Are you trying to keep me? When Dana Perino turns.
Dana Perino hosts the show. And I believe it had to do with some level of creepiness. And your picture popped up. And I just went, you too?
And too. Oh, Perino.
Wow. So I will have you know, last night when I hosted, there were no Kill Me shots.
Would you have taken them out?
Yeah, here's the thing.
You wrote it.
I write my own stuff.
Oh, okay.
So at no point was I going to shoot who I just don't understand it. Like anybody who needs help, Kill Me's there because it's not like you're going home. Like, you know, you don't even have lunch breaks.
Right. I do eat at my desk.
Yeah, you do. You know,
you say that's in my backpack store?
Yeah, that's keep your good stuff in there.
Darius, last thing. Is I had I interviewed Greg twice in a half hour, one for Fox and Friends, and then one for the Saturday Show.
Yeah,
for his book Late Night, and in it we bumped in the Fox and Friends with all his hits on me.
Right,
and I said, "Explain yourself," and we just went back and forth. People are writing headlines: "Kill Me gets his revenge,"
right.
Demands it. That's not what I said. We're just having fun. Explain it, but it goes to show you, even though we're in the media. Anytime you do something on Fox, they're not going to understand it.
No, well, or they're going to try to make it literal.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, absolutely literal.
Yeah.
You know, because I said I was talking about, we were talking about neo-pronouns, right? And basically my philosophy on that is if you are spending time inventing things for yourself instead of competing, like if you're not doing well in school, then you say, well, you identify as a non-school learner, you know, or whatever the hell it is. And I said, if my children came home with that attitude and instead of doing their homework, they said, these are my pronouns, daddy. I said, well, my pronoun would have been, I think I said butt whipping, but I was using the A word, right? Next day, Tyrus threatens to assault children.
That's right. I saw that. I never read the article.
Assault children. No one read. No one read the article. Like at least when we had like the old tabloids, it'd be like Tyrus has a lucid affair with Batwoman. You know,
that
like something
cool,
like cooler.
Right.
Tyrus finally fit on alien spaceship. Hopefully they'll keep him.
Right.
So, you know, but like it's just that's they try to go literal to try to get a thing, you know, and you going after Gutfeld, I think it's passwords. I'm retired. I happen to know a promoter by the name of Billy Corgan. You know, at some point, I think you got to say, with your UFC background and your clear upper body strength, you just ripped the microphone off the thing.
Right, yeah.
I think it's time to call Gutfeld out. Man to man, let's settle this in the ring. And let's just make it happen.
Do we make it early morning or late night?
Oh, you make it early morning.
Okay.
Because that way it will be quick. And literally, as soon as you get done, we'll have your suit pressed and ready for you, and you won't miss any of your hits.
You remember Brian Kilmeade did the first five UFCs.
That's what I'm saying.
I went to school on this stuff.
You went to school stuff. You hung out with one of the toughest human beings on the planet, Jim Brown.
Right.
Like, you have complete advantage.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, whose own story personifies what good education can do, called it a national humiliation. And for once, she wasn't talking about Kilmeade's haircut.
So, Tyrus, I can't. Give me a second to compose myself. Yeah, Dana Perino. I'm the only person she's ever went after, ever.
Oh, and if you would have kept that going, you would have heard us like, why? Why? I threw my hands up. Why? What are we doing here? Kilmeade's on. And here's the thing. She also used foul language. She dropped an MF-er at the end of her thing. She was like.
Not to do with me.
No, she was jacked too. Like she had done some planks or some pull-ups.
Yeah, she was.
She was. I had never seen this side of her. It was completely aggressive, and I don't understand it. You guys worked together on the five that day. There was no reason for hostilities. Like, I just, you know, I don't know.
Put it this way: not only did I work the next day, and there was not even acknowledgement of the shot given. She must think that I'm over it. I am not over it.
You know what she assumes is because you get up early. I think Greg thinks the same thing. There's no way he's going to see this.
Yeah, but the problem
is, you have eyes and ears everywhere.
I do. And the problem is now it's on at 10 o'clock, so I'm watching the repeat when I'm coming to work. So I see it all.
Yeah.
And my self-esteem will never recover.
I mean, what's going on with Dana? You and I are having a heartfelt thing about my retirement, and she talks about my calves?
Oh, yeah. Like,
what is with all the anger?
I know. It's unbelievable.
To a guy who never skips leg day, like squirrels confuse my legs for trees. Like, it was just unbelievably
cold. I don't want
to
put you on the spot, but after this, I have a few reads to do. Do you want to go to Human Resources?
You know what? No. Can you imagine running her in the hallway? She terrorizes me. There's two people I fear at Fox. That's Judge Jeanine and Dana Perino. I always stay on their good side.
There's one thing you'll never see: Tyrus in the waiting room inside Human Resources to file a complaint.
I think they'd be like, are you kidding me? Your feelings are hurt.
So
look at you.
The other thing that I find fascinating is this guy, Oliver Anthony. I read a column yesterday by Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Every Democrat hates it. And he said, what happened to the Democratic Party? If you listen to the words, if you listen to what he said, that used to be the Democratic Party. He's going to bat for the little guy who says that they get taxed too much and other people don't. North of Richmond used to be a problem. Did everything goes outside the joke when he said, if you're 5'3" and 300 pounds, I don't want to support your junk food. Besides that, he says everything else he said used to be the Democratic Party. And then he got mad that the Republicans were saying, you're my anthem. So here he is on Joe Rogan. I want you to hear some of it.
When a person like yourself gets labeled a right-wing, left-wing fanatic, like right out of the gate.
both in like a week and a half. Then, yeah, at least I know I'm doing something right.
You know, why do people have to attack?
Well, I think it's just for whatever reason I'm the subject matter the last couple of weeks. In everyone's defense, I probably haven't. I've waited for this opportunity, I guess, to really have a real conversation with somebody about whatever it is I am. So people are just trying to find who's this Oliver Anthony guy and what is he and where does he work and who did he vote for and what's his family like and yada, because they want to sort of build this image of whatever it is that the person behind the song represents, for better or for worse.
Right.
It's really funny to watch on my end, because obviously I know what's true and what's not. And so, like, just even what I've skimmed through of people sending me, like singing at the Super Bowl, like how many people have formed an opinion about whether or not I should be paid to sing at the Super Bowl. Like, I'm not singing saying it's a Super Bowl. That's just somebody made up. There's been hundreds of hours of people's time wasted probably talking about all these little, like, things that don't even exist. It's just somebody made them up and put them on the internet. And so I'm just letting them ride. I think it's great.
It's wild.
I just think it's great, like, that at least the last couple of weeks I've been able to entertain everyone and get everyone's mind off, like, all the other horrible stuff that's going on in the world right now.
So what do you think, Tyrus? What do you think about the phenom a week later?
You know, I think here's the point. And I think what happened to the Democratic Party is pretty easy. Bernie Sanders brought the socialism in, and it just spread. Because now moderate Democrats are considered right-wing. Like, Bill Maher has not changed his politics at all. But he's right-wing. You know what? But it's not just him. It's everybody. You know, recently there was an article written about me how my net worth was, I think it was $5 million. But I had blown it all on poker and drugs.
And nothing to do with
that. I just wrote back, sir, I've never played poker. You know, like, you know, it's just they try to throw things on the wall for the reaction. You know, they get the reaction because usually if you say 10 bad things about somebody, they're hoping that the laws of averages, 40% of it will be right. And then you just connect the thing with feelings. And there's no facts and just anything that's said against the narrative because it's the progressive party now. And they're the minority, but they're convincing everyone that they're this giant thing.
But the voting base, the blue collars, is moving to Republicans. I mean, they've picked it up.
If you're – because of very simple things. When you go to the grocery store and your average bill for the last – and not let's take President Trump out of it. During Obama, grocery bills weren't ridiculous either. So if you averaged $150 a week for a family of four for groceries, and then all of a sudden that same grocery bill is now $300, you're going to have a problem. Because that money has to come from somewhere else. And then all of a sudden your light bill's up 40% because the taxes to keep your light bill going. And everyone talked about gas. No one talked about electricity. Electricity bills were killing people.
Utility, absolutely.
At one point you were looking at, now all of a sudden your light bill was $85. Now it's $285. So now that's $500 that you're out now and you're not getting a raise. That's all that really they care about. When their check comes and they divide it up, I got to pay for this, I got to pay for that, pay for that. And then, like, they don't have anything left.
What do we promote for Tyrus?
I got my live events. You look it up on my link tree. And, of course, Nuff Said comes out in November. You can pre-order now on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
All right, good. We'll promote each other's books. Right.
And I will not insult you on air.
Thank you.
Only in person.
This is Jimmy Fallon, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.